Not often. I try not to respond solely to news, but this tragedy Friday is of such impact to minds and hearts, and it's not my purpose today to rehearse the news or to even try to analyze the news of this tragedy, but it is of significant concern that Christians everywhere should be heartbroken. I'm sure every parent, every grandparent can grieve with just the images that come to mind with this tragedy. And I am given a passage that many are using now in Matthew chapter 2. Verse number 16. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceeding wroth, sent forth, slew all the children that were in Bethlehem, and all the coast thereof, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, in Ramah was there a voice heard, lamentation, weeping, great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and would not be comforted, because they are not. Rachel, of course, was Jacob, Israel's beloved wife, who died in Bethlehem in childbirth. Father, I pray today for Christians and counselors who are gathered there in a little town in Connecticut. And Father, they are having a church service here or there. Some names we know of pastors and churches that are meeting this morning. And I can't begin to fathom what it must be like to stand and to preach Christ and the resurrection in such overwhelming grief. But I know that's the only message they have, Father, and I'm glad they have that message. But I know they'll, neighbors and friends will try to help and try to comfort just listening to the grieving. And as Brother Kittle prayed, we don't even know how to pray about this, and we lack wisdom about it, and we ask you to give us wisdom. We ask you to give us discretion and good sense, and especially for those on the front lines of spiritual ministry. I pray for them this morning. And I'm mindful also that death is no respecter of persons, no respecter of age, no respecter of geography. And I realize that each of us gathered here today, we have no knowledge of what a day will bring forth. We don't know how much time you've given to us, but we ask that you would help us to redeem the time. We ask these things in Jesus Christ's name, who is the resurrection and the life. Amen. I have to share with you some foolish things I've heard in the last several hours. Not from you, and I hope not from us, but foolish statements. What will Christians say about this? I think that's a foolish question. We'll say exactly what we said before this tragedy happened. Jesus Christ is the hope of the world. The tragedy doesn't change the need this world has for the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we don't say that unkindly, and I don't say that to gloss over the insinuation that somehow Christianity has failed this nation. Perhaps, but more likely, this nation has failed the offer of Christianity. But be that as it may, I have to tell you, as you comfort friends, and you need to know that some among us, and perhaps you, are very much moved to grief. Someone told me about a dear saint who just cannot, is just not coping with this. Not related, but just the news has just overwhelmed her. You need to be aware of that. One pastor gave good advice. There does come a point in time in which you do need to turn off the 24-hour news cycle. You do need to separate from it a little bit and just close your eyes or shift your mind to something. This morning when I got back to church, I like to walk through the Sunday school rooms, and I just wanted to see the children and say good morning. I hope I never take that for granted again. I like to walk through the Sunday school rooms and see what kind of cookies they're having. This is a good time to walk past and to see the children gathered around their teachers, and it's a good time to go into the breakfast room, do a quick survey and see what the popular cereal is. Not Fruit Loops, but Lucky Charms. They're magically delicious. And I like to go in there, and I appreciate Anita and Ruby and others that help with the little breakfast room, and I hope I never take that for granted. Some children called. Actually, a mother called and said, "My children this morning are at grandma's. Can you get them?" And just in the providence of God, it was just perfect. Yes, we could. Can't always do that. But as it was, grandma's house was right on a place where we could get to them. And I didn't know where the house was, but I drove past and the children were standing out and with little shining faces. And they saw the van and their little faces kind of lit up. I thought, you know, I guess maybe they were wondering, is he coming or not? You know, is he going to be here? Sometimes it doesn't work out, but I was so glad. I slowed down, stopped, rolled the window down. And I said, I'm going down. I'm turning around. I'll be back. And they danced a little jig, you know, and they were waiting. And I hope I never take that for granted. So Christianity will speak the truth that it spoke on Thursday. Our message will not change. I have to say this, and I wouldn't say this if I was dealing with a parent in that little town this morning, but I will say this. There is no one else who has any message for you. What would the evolutionists say? In a million years, we won't have these kind of problems. Really? Oh, I'm sure that's a real consolation to a grieving mother. I'm sure that's going to solve the sadness of, well, we're going to evolve into a higher state. Yeah, there's a lot of comfort. That's the most miserable message I've ever heard. If it was true, it's useless. It's absolutely useless. By the way, it's not true. The secularist answer, well, we're going to make sure this never happens again. I admire that sentiment. I don't think you can do that. But if you could do that, what comfort is that to the mother who grieves this morning? What comfort is to say, we're never going to let that happen again? Yeah, I heard that after Columbine. I've heard it after every tragedy. And I understand why we say that. But somehow, it still happens. So, the evolutionist has no gospel. The secularist has no gospel. The psychologist has no gospel. And I told somebody the other day, I didn't think it was possible for the media to make things worse. But it still manages to do so. It's the story is so mangled and muddled. And you say, well, you know, we don't have to know people's names immediately. Next of kin deserves to be notified by the authorities, not by some reporter sticking a microphone in their face. But that's such an insignificant observation. My only point is that the secularists have no, the psychologist of, well, why did this happen? And what was this frame of mind? And what could, and all kinds of theories. They don't have any answers. They don't have any solutions. They don't have any guarantees that, well, here are the warning signs of... you say, well, here are 10 things that could be done better. I'll tell you, one of the most stirring, heroic stories of the whole event were teachers and principals who... bless their hearts, they did the right thing. They reacted as best they could. The principal who runs and shields the children and announces, the intercom was turned on so that others would know, and I mean some of those teachers, they had their children barricaded in a closet right now. One story that touched my heart is the police get there and they knock on the storage room, and bless that teacher's heart, she said, how do I know you're the police? I'm thinking, whoa, the presence of mind. I thought, yes, how would you know? The door is closed and someone says, we're the police. I'm not opening the door till I'm sure it's the police. I bless that teacher's heart. I mean, somebody had the presence of mind to think like that. Many lives were spared because teachers and one little boy is walking down the hallway and bullets are flying and some teacher risks her life and pulls him into a room. And I can tell you those stories, and we'll hear more about those, and we'll hear about people who, the secretary who was distraught because she was absent that day. She was not able to go to school that day. My point with all that, and even the discussion of well, the response was right, and the district had implemented recently new procedures, and it sounds like they did try to follow those procedures, and maybe lives were spared. I think they were spared. But here's the answer. 20 children still lost their lives. It's incomprehensible. It's why so many have thought of Rachel here would not be comforted. There's no way for of secularism or evolution or psychology to make this right. There's in a bizarre kind of way, there's no manhunt for the assailant. If it's true, if we know what we know, the assailant himself is now dead. And so there's going to be no manhunt. There's going to be no trial of that person or no seeking after what should we do. And all I'm saying is, and those who would find other explanations or, you know, that'll go on. The fact of the matter is, the world doesn't have any answer to this either. The world doesn't have any explanation for this. The world doesn't have any way to avoid this. You say, well, I have no doubt that in that district, their procedures will become even more strict. And I understand that. I who could argue with that? Who could debate that? But the fact of the matter is, as one senator observed, evil walked through that little town. And lo and behold, evil is a person, not a disembodied spirit, not just some influence. Evil walks in us. Now, the only worldview that has any comfort to offer people today is a gospel that says this life is not all there is. This breath you breathe, this body in which you dwell, is not the end of it. There is a world beyond this world. There is life beyond this life. And we want to avoid being upset by foolish things that people say. And we certainly want to avoid saying those foolish things. I think in comforting, you need to even be careful. It's like when you say, like, well, you know what they should have done. Well, there'll be a time for those after action reports and, you know, schools that say we'll do this and parents will say we'll do this. I understand that. It's too late to say that now about this tragedy. It's too late to say, well, you know, well, this is what should have happened on Wednesday or Tuesday or last week or a Friday week. Oh, this is what they should have done. You got to be careful with that. Because most of the time, people know what they should have done or could have done or thought to have done. It's just that our minds don't always work that way. And so, whatever going forward, whatever people say or do or want to do to make things safer, or no one will quibble with that, but let's be careful about saying, well, you know what they should have done Tuesday. You know what should have happened, you know, before this. It's too late. It's too late. It's too late. And so if our message is just, well, I know why it happened and I know what went wrong and I know how it could be stopped. And that's all well and good for you and your future. It doesn't change anything about Friday. Not one whistle. Nothing. What I want to do today is take this passage here that, when I think of the timeless truths of Bethlehem, that's one of my favorite sermon series. There's some timeless truth about the Bethlehem nativity story, the birth of Christ. And the star and its significance, and the wise men and their worship, Mary and her meekness, Joseph and his generosity, Bethlehem and its beauty, and there's a list of them. The most disturbing, timeless truth of Bethlehem is the king and his cruelty, and that's this king here. This is. Believe it or not, this is a king who was called Herod the Great. He was considered to be, although a pawn of the Romans, still in his own realm, in his own little world, a great king of the Jews. He was a great builder and a great designer of architecture, and he was rebuilding the temple at Jerusalem there. There had been Solomon's temple, then there was a temple of the restoration, which was much more modest. And then Herod, he decides to build a temple that will dwarf even Solomon's temple. He never really completed it. They've been working on it 46 years, and it wasn't done yet. As a matter of fact, it was never completed because the Romans leveled the city in AD 70, and Herod the Great dies, of course, you know, soon after the birth of Christ. But it is a project that was never completed and was later completely destroyed by the Romans. But Herod the Great was a man of some importance, probably far more in his own mind than in the grand scheme of geopolitics, but he was a big man. And when the wise men come to visit the Christ child, they take their eyes off the star. And they start thinking, you know, well, the capital is Jerusalem. I know the wise men were men because the Bible says so, but I also know they're men because they got lost. The wise would be sitting there with the GPS and the map, and they say, well, you know, it says Bethlehem. And the wise men said, oh, I know where I am now. They stopped looking at the GPS. I know where I am now. In the fifth grade, I saw a map of Judea, and I know the capital's right. It's right over here. They got lost. They go to the capital, and you jump ahead in the story. You understand that God is still sovereign over that, but they're the ones who tell Herod that the Christ child has been born. And sure enough, Herod's wise men know that it is in Bethlehem that the Christ child would be born. Micah 5:2 says, in Bethlehem, we know the Bible promises that 700 years before Christ. In verse number 5 of chapter 2, they said unto him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, and thou, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, art not the least among the princes of Judah, for out of thee shall come a governor that shall rule my people Israel. Now, Herod tells the wise men to go find this Christ child, this king, and then report back to him. His plan, of course, is to kill him. Verse 13 says, when they departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother, flee into Egypt, and be there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. Joseph, Jesus' guardian, takes the mother of Jesus, and they escape to Egypt. Herod, meanwhile, sees that he's mocked, and he becomes angry. The first thing I want you to notice today is that sin is born of selfishness, and you can't always rein in the consequences. You can't always, once sin breaks forth, you might think it's a small sin. You might think it's an innocuous sin. You might think it's not a major sin. But once sin is unleashed, it's like a fast moving cancer. It's like a tornado, a spiritual tornado that sweeps through your soul, and it will break any barrier imaginable. Sin unleashed. And it doesn't matter if it's the sin of pride or covetousness Whatever the motivation is, whatever unleashes the sin soon overwhelms the sinner. Now, I believe the sinner is still responsible, by the way. I believe Herod's responsible for his anger. But if later Herod said, I lost my temper and I did that bad thing. Well, Herod, that was your temper. You're responsible for that. But whatever Herod's pride or ego was, he could not brook a competitor. Why, I am the king. There'll be no other kings. I'm the king. You can't begin to tell how insecure he must have been that he was threatened by a baby. That a baby was the king, or would be the king, or would someday be the king. Herod's plan is to destroy the child, and his anger is unleashed. And his answer is to slay all the children. He calculates the visit, adds 6 months. I mean, he's mechanical. He's like a Nazi with this. It's like, well, let's speculate. Here's the parameters of the ages, and this is the outside limits, and we'll add. And every child under two and under, he orders them. There may not have been a Holocaust like that in the Bible since the time of Pharaoh, the time of Moses, when Pharaoh ordered all the male babies to be killed. It doesn't seem that Herod even bothered to specify male or female. Point number one, sin unleashed is uncontrollable. Sin will take you farther than you want to go. It'll keep you there longer than you want to stay. It'll cost you a whole lot more than you ever dreamed you'd pay. Sin is like this venomous snake in our taking to our bosom, and we think I can control it. It's just this one sin. It's just this one thing. It's just this one thing that I have to have, and it can destroy everybody in your world. If not physically, it can destroy them emotionally or mentally. Sin. If we could just for a moment see how sinful sin is, we would not love it so much. We would not alibi for it so much. We would not excuse it so much. We would be as quick to rid ourselves of it and to run from it as we were to embrace it and to justify it. Sin is unpredictable. You don't know where sin's going to take you. David looked on a woman, lusted after her. I would imagine that he never... I want to think that David didn't think when he was lusting that he would actually commit adultery. But soon he did commit adultery. But I hope when he was just lusting after that woman, I hope he wasn't calculating, well, I would murder for that woman. But he did. That sin unleashed in David's mind, I want to give him the benefit of the doubt and say he didn't calculate that that's where it would take him, but that's exactly where it took him. He didn't realize that sin and the consequences of it would cost him a baby, two sons, a raped daughter, a heartache in his household that never left. I want to think that David didn't see that coming. He probably should have seen it coming. He should have known, but he didn't. I don't know that he knew. But you see, he's like the rest of us. We think, well, it's just this one sin. It's just this one disobedience. It's just this one area. I know God said that I should do this and be this, but you know, and we harbor it. And sin, it's unpredictable. I'm sure every type of sin has this kind of exponential disaster hooked to it. The gambler, the drinker, the drug addict, the embezzler, the reader and viewer of pornography. They posit that they can handle this, and it just explodes. And lives are destroyed, and marriages are destroyed, and churches are destroyed. Communities are destroyed. I'm sure as time goes by, we'll hear analysis of this assailant's life, and here's what was wrong with his life, and here's the bad thing he did, and here's a good thing that he missed, and here's all these little factors. The fact of the matter is, we're not going to know. It's ironic that in a household you have this one son and another son. You say, but well, there was this other complication. I know, we'll hear all about it. The point I'm making is that sin, you just don't know where sin's going to take you. My warning to you, and you sit here this morning, you say, well, my sin is nothing like that. It's my sin is just this secret chamber in my heart. My sin is just this, it's just a little bit of bitterness. Just some bitterness. I don't do anything wrong. I just sit around and think to myself about how unfair things are, how people mistreat me. I can't tell you how trivialities wash away from my mind as long as I'm thinking about that tragedy in Connecticut. Things that bothered me, I'm not thinking about them. I'm not thinking about little trivial offenses or trivial things or trivial hurts or aches. Not thinking about it. I know I went around to the Sunday school rooms today, and I got to see my granddaughters and pat their little cheek, tap them on the head, tell them I missed them. And there are some grandparents today that can't do that. Now, I'm not saying we'll never, ever grumble again, or we'll never, ever be perturbed again, or we'll never, ever be upset again. I'm just saying, in the scheme of things, I think about things that are bothering me, and I think about things that are bothering parents and grandparents in a community. I think this is silly for me to worry about this. That's ridiculous. Number one, sin is an exponential disaster waiting to happen. Number two, and this may sound like a cliche, and this may sound like gospel speak, this may sound like Christian gibberish to you. I hope it doesn't. But I mean this from the bottom of my heart. And if this isn't true, then nothing's true. But I believe this is true. And that is, our God is a sovereign God and is in control of all things. You say, well, that raises some questions for me. Well, of course it does. That's because you don't have the mind of God. That's because you don't declare the end from the beginning. You can't hardly see the middle from the middle. If you're like me, you think, well, I didn't see that coming. I didn't know that was going to happen. Sometimes my best plans don't go like I planned them. That ever happened to anybody else? I'm just saying, I can't hardly get a two-car parade to work. You know, I was like, come on, you know. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. I'm not really a mastermind. I'm not really a genius. I'm not really able to get all the ducks lined up. That's why I worry about people who are trying to get all their ducks lined up. Because I got to tell you, it's hard to do. It's hard to get all the ducks lined up. It's more like herding cats than anything else. It's like just sort of get behind them and hope they go in the right direction. But all I'm saying is, I know God is sovereign. You say, well, Pastor, why did this happen? And why did this happen? Why did this not happen? It's like, well, I don't know. Did I mention that God is sovereign and not I? That God is omniscient and not us. Not we. We're not omniscient. So when people say, well, why did God do it this way? Why didn't God? I don't know. But I trust Him. I trust Him. You say, well, I don't know. We're going to fix this and we're going to change this and we're going to make things. Really? No, you're not. We remind me of the guy in the Bible who's meets a lion and he runs. He runs into a bear. He runs away from the bear. He goes into his house, leans up, shuts the door, and a snake bites him. That's the way we are. Oh, we're never going to let that happen again. Yeah. And somebody will mix up a load of fertilizer and drive a truck into a building. Or somebody will hijack an airplane and crash it into your building. Or somebody will send poison to you through the mail. Or someone will go to the drugstore and spike the Tylenol. You say, oh, no, that couldn't happen again. Oh, really? I'm not trying to cheer you up. I'm just saying, don't sit around and say, well, I'm safe. I double bolted my door and I don't go into that place and I don't go to there and I'm going to stay away from there. Well, fine. I'm not criticizing you for looking both ways before you cross the street. But God is sovereign, God's omniscient, and you and I are not. Just do the best you can. Leave the rest to God. But I take great comfort from the fact that God is sovereign. Do you mean God allowed this? And that God is sovereignly working this necessity of His Son being taken to Egypt? And God's going to call His Son out of Egypt, and that's going to fulfill a prophecy? Wasn't there another way to fulfill that prophecy? Wasn't there another? I don't know. I'm not God. But I trust Him. I trust Him. The number last. Here in the middle of this king and his cruelty, I know, no doubt that Satan's involved in this. I'm not completely naive. I know that the devil and his angels are seeking whom they may devour. And I know they are, demonic possession's a real thing. I know it happens. I don't believe a Christian can be demonically possessed. I think we can be oppressed. But I don't know all that the devil's able to do. I know he's not as great as God. I know his power is limited. He's not omniscient. I don't know what kind of demonic activity could be unleashed. I don't know what demonic role played in this. It certainly seems diabolical to me. It certainly seems devilish. If ever I could call something devilish, this would have to be diabolical. But my point being this, I don't know what the devil may be doing. But I do know this, that if the devil was trying to kill the baby Jesus, that would certainly, he's the father of lies. He hates God. If the devil was behind this, if he was behind, Pharaoh trying to kill the Israelites, if he hates the Jews, he hates Israel. The devil hates Israel to this day. That the origin of anti-Semitism is the devil. The devil hates the Jew. Now, my point being this. I don't know what the devil's scheme was here. I do know what God's plan was. This baby, this son given, was to grow up and live an absolutely sinless life. And he was going to offer himself as a substitute for sinners. And all who trust him have their sins forgiven and a home in heaven. All those little children, too young to understand, too young to know right from wrong. The grace of a sovereign, loving God says, suffer the little ones to come to me. I believe all things are going to work out according to the counsel of God's will. And I know the point of this tragedy here is swallowed up in the cross of Jesus Christ. Let me warn you, people may say, oh, that's too simplistic. That's too sentimental. What hope is that? Will that really comfort a heart? Listen, it's the only gospel we have. Now, I know the scale of the tragedy is breathtaking. But do you really think that an individual mother, let's think of just one mother right now. Do you really think that one mother, that her grief is greater because there were 19 others? If her child is dead? Put this in, all I'm trying to get you to say is, how many mothers buried a child this week? Not all of them were in Danbury, Connecticut. Now, I know we put their grief, we say, oh, 20. But think of them one at a time. One at a time. That mother's grief, now I'm not saying the surroundings of it and the tragedy of it doesn't make it worse, but the loss of the child is the loss of the child. It doesn't matter if that baby died in Cincinnati Children's Hospital or the Burns Institute or in St. Jude's in a leukemia ward. It doesn't matter where the child died. It doesn't matter if it died from some as collateral damage in some war somewhere. A child's death is a child's death. My point being, this is the only gospel we have. This is the only hope we have. This is the only way to heaven that I know. That the resurrection and the life, Jesus Christ, is the overarching purpose of even this king and his cruelty. Herod cannot stop the gospel of Jesus Christ. He can send his army out to slaughter the innocents. The baby Jesus is in Egypt. So much for King Herod. He's despicably vile. He's diabolical. He's evil. He would slaughter thousands of children. You know what? He also failed. He was a failure on many scales. On many. He was a failure morally and spiritually. He was also a failure as a diabolical evil ruler. Didn't get it done, Herod. Your big scheme, you control armies, soldiers will kill babies for you. Wow, Herod, you must really be powerful. You're also a failure. By the way, Herod, you're soon going to die. You're going to die before Jesus ever comes back from Egypt. You're not going to outlive the Egyptian sojourn. So much for Herod the Great. Make no mistake, the heartache he unleashed. Rachel, weeping for her children, would not be comforted. I don't say this or preach this to say that we can wipe away people's tears with it or take away their sorrow with it. I don't even think that's the time to do that. But I do think we have a gospel that lets us sorrow, not without hope. A resurrection, a Christ who conquers death, hell, and the grave. It's our only hope. It's our only message. Let's bow our heads. As the funeral director and I drove out to Etown Cemetery Friday, the news had just broken about this terrible tragedy. It was still unfolding, the reports. When I got to the funeral home, I met met Dennis there, and we sat down for a few moments and gathered our thoughts about it. Then we got in the coach together and drove out to the cemetery and had a funeral service out there. It's one of the most surreal moments I have ever felt. I didn't know the deceased. I didn't know the family, really. But as I read the scriptures, as I preached the gospel as best I know how, my heart was overwhelmed by these mothers and daddies and grandmothers and grandfathers and aunts and uncles and neighbors and friends who were stunned by evil walking in their midst. And I realized the gospel is all I have. I don't have any answers for the psychologist. I don't have any answers for the policeman. I don't have any answers for the politicians. I don't have any answers that would satisfy the social workers. I don't have any answers that would satisfy the community. I don't have any solutions for what we should have done and what we'll do better. And I have opinions like everybody, but I don't have any solutions. But I do have a gospel. And when it's all said and done, I'd rather have the gospel than all those other answers and all those other solutions and all those other remedies that, dear child of God, they are just temporary anyway. They're just temporal. What you need is someone who can deal with the sin problem and who can raise you from the dead. Do you know Christ? Do you serve Him as Lord? Father, bless this service. I pray someone would be helped in it. In Jesus' name. Let's stand.